Another one of those days when I wonder whether there's really a need for a sermon. First Unitarian Church is a beacon of hope for us and for our community, a spiritual center in the heart of our city that helps each of us find our moral compass, calling and challenging us to build the beloved community with an ever-deepening sense of spirit, diversity, and inclusion. The First Unitarian Vision Statement, developed and adopted by our board 4 years ago, tries to put into language both our yearnings and our commitments. To build the beloved community with an ever-deepening sense of spirit, diversity, and inclusion. Diversity and inclusion. What do those words mean to us and for us? Are they describing Black Elk's vision? And I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one large circle wide as daylight and starlight, and in the center grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all of the children in all of their diverse hoops. The sacred hoop of my people, Black Elk says, the distinct cultural and relational hoop of our identity was one of many hoops, one of many other distinct and cultural and relational identities that together make one larger circle under the one mighty tree that shades them all. Out of many, one, e pluribus unum. But the many do not blend in this vision. They do not lose their distinctiveness. Now, Black Elk is writing from the margins. The Lakota had been defeated militarily. He had accepted reservation life and, in fact, converted to Catholicism before he wrote this. The hoop of his people is in danger of extinction. And in the vision he casts, difference persists. Difference is valued. Difference is, in fact, perhaps necessary to preserve identity. Now, I'm pushing Black Elk's language here. I know that I am. But I do believe that Black Elk prayed that the identity of the Lakota would have an ongoingness, even in the midst of the diversity beneath that one spiritual tree, that it would not be homogenized into a dominant culture. So is that how diversity and difference live in the beloved community of our vision, of your vision, with our individuality and our various identities preserved, our separateness not melted into sameness? Or do we imagine something closer to what A. Powell Davies described in our call to worship? Davies was one of the most successful Unitarian ministers in our history, planting 8 now large UU congregations in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and preaching every Sunday to cabinet officers and Supreme Court justices in the pews of All Souls Church. From Davies. Here we are, all of us, all upon this planet, bound together in a common destiny. Common destiny. Living our lives between the briefness of the daylight and the dark. Kindred in this, each lighted by the same precarious flame of life, how does it happen that we are not kindred in all things else? How strange and foolish are these walls of separation that divide us? I'm going to break it down for you a little bit. Bound together in our common destiny, that's Black Elk's one tree appearing again. But Davies calls us out as individuals, not as members of a people. Each of us lighted by that same flame, each of us individually. And the walls separating us are separating us as individuals, walls of prejudice and prejudgment against which Davies fought. Now, walls offer a loaded image these days. We think of our president's border wall to keep asylum seekers and job seekers, brown and black people, out. We think of the walls of paperwork that are keeping the Bahamian immigrants out, walls that separate and hold us down. Davies calls those walls strange and foolish, and by implication, calls for them to be torn down. But walls and boundaries and distinctiveness can also define a culture and shape a people and hold an identity. Davies' language suggests, frankly, the melting pot, suggests a blending that would follow the tearing down of those walls, suggests at least that we can make common cause around what we share rather than around the particularities of our specific communities and our specific identities. Here, too, I'm pushing Davies' language, and I know that as well. But I do believe that Davies assumed commonality as possible and powerful. As he says, how does it happen that we are not kindred in all things else? It's a different vision of beloved community, a vision that suggests that the uniqueness of our various tribes could be, might be, perhaps should be, of less importance than our common humanity. Two different visions of beloved community. And I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand about which is the one that you hold. I'm not going to do that because, truth be told, they both live in me. And perhaps they both live in you too. So rather than forcing a choice, let me just point to a few things that may be helpful as you think about this. First, that vision of common humanity, that vision of blending, well, that vision has most often meant in practice that the dominant culture has gotten to define what is common and what is shared. And surprise, surprise, the commonalities almost always look like that dominant culture. It's just amazing. It always works. So this is where our work on the culture of white supremacy intersects with our work on visioning. So that's the first thing. It takes real vigilance to keep power and privilege from having a shaping role in our visioning. That is why there is so much need to center the voices of those who are on the margins so that power and privilege do not even unintentionally preserve their prominence. Second, I don't want my identity, my various identities, to be blended into some sameness. Do you? My identity as an African American connects me to my ancestors, to their strength, and to mine. My identity as male, as a person with education, these identities are central to me. I would lose myself if I lost them. Third, there are so few models of multiple identities sharing the shade of that one tree successfully. There are plenty of examples of homogeneity, of separate communities built around a particular racial or ethnic or linguistic or religious identity, plenty of examples in the religious world, in the black church, in the Polish churches, Jewish synagogues, mosques, and plenty of examples of one identity group forcing others out of the shade. But few examples of multiple identities successfully sharing a collective space. Perhaps that's why that vision is so hard to bring into focus, Black Elk's vision. There are so few models to follow. And then finally, there is the perversity of diversity. That's right, the perversity of diversity. The phrase has a couple of meanings. The first is that a particular kind of diversity becomes easier and easier to create and sustain when that diversity already exists. Just think about it. It's harder for a younger person to imagine that this might be a welcoming home for them when they look into this sanctuary and see mostly gray heads. Same is true for a person of color and perhaps for a trans person. One of the signs of welcome is to see people who look like you. It's the perversity of diversity, despite our best wishes. But there's another meaning. Mark Morrison Reed describes the wish for diversity in our faith as a real conundrum. Because we say we want change. We say we want real diversity. But we don't want to change too much. We want to change the look of the faces in the sanctuary, but not the culture of the church. Mark argues that Unitarian Universalists will settle for looking different without being different. Now, most of those who are already here like what we have found. And frankly, we want to stay in our comfort zones. Is this sounding at all familiar to you? There were a few chuckles as I went through that last piece. Do you know what he means? Comfort zones. In the last few weeks, I have been asking groups in the church how our congregational work on the culture of white supremacy is landing for them and what they are hearing from other congregants. I've asked our board, my ministerial relations committee, our staff leaders, and others. And the feedback has been enormously helpful. The affirmation of the work has been good to hear, of course, and there has been affirmation. People, especially relatively younger and folks newer to the church, have told me that that focus is why they come. These are white-identified folks for the most part, and they talk about how dismantling racism and the culture of patriarchy and heteronormity is central to their spiritual lives, central in their search for wholeness. Several spoke of wishing, frankly, that we were moving further and even faster in the work. The affirmation of the work has been important to hear, but so has the discomfort. Folks spoke about still tripping over the language. The culture of white supremacy still makes some wonder if they're being accused of being white supremacists personally. They're not, but I can understand that the language raises a question. Some spoke of the whole business of being woke and centering voices from the margins as a kind of political correctness that closes off conversation rather than opening up our hearts to change. Now, I and we try to guard against that here in the church, but you know, this is a broader conversation out in our world. This is not just taking place here in First Unitarian. And I personally try to avoid that woke language, but I'm sure self-righteousness slips into some of our conversations, or feels like it does to some of us. For those on the margins, the people of color and the trans folks and others, well, those members of our community know that their ability to remain and to thrive here is dependent on that focus. It enables their presence, enables our presence, as awkward as it can be. And for all of us who reject the hatred and the violence that are being peddled as policy in our world, isn't the least we are called to do to welcome those folks who find their way into our sanctuary? Isn't that the minimum we are called to do? Is that too high a bar for us? Mark Morrison Reed argues that the central task of the religious community is to unveil the bonds that unite each to all. To unveil the bonds that unite each to all. Some of those bonds, some of that connectedness, is grounded in pain, in not being seen, in not being valued, in not being heard. It is a bond, and it is part of our history, part of our present, but it is not warm and fuzzy. We come together as a people, some of whom have been hurt, some of whom intentionally, but mostly unintentionally, have done some of the hurting. We start with ourselves, with that person in the mirror, and hear the call of our faith, that call of our best selves, calling us to change our ways. We need reconciliation, yes, we do. But that reconciliation needs to be grounded in the value of real community, the value of being seen and being heard and being loved as who we truly are. We hear that call and we try to change and, frankly, to compensate for how we have all of us, fallen short in the past. We name our pronouns, we worry about cultural misappropriation. We're sensitive that some of the language we use has to change. We put paper signs across our bathroom signage to make them more welcoming. Some of the assumptions about who should and shouldn't be in that sanctuary, they have to change too. Who gets questions or a raised eyebrow or a second look when they try to come into this space? Those things need to change. And it's awkward. And it does not feel natural to many of us. And we make mistakes. And some of us wonder how the culture that we love could have become a barrier to others who yearn for what we have found here. How could that be? And some of us wonder if it's worth all the effort, all this focusing on our differences. But as one congregant wrote to me just this week, change is really hard. Asking ourselves to step out and make change happen when it's not forced on us takes something more. Sometimes I wish for the old comfort, but there really is no such thing. We can't go backwards and become unaware again. We can't become unaware again. But the awkwardness is real. Because we are trying to do a new thing, a thing that has not been done. We're trying actually and in real time to live out the promise of this liberal faith. And there is therefore no way to think our way into the beloved community. We have to live our way into it, each of us and all of us. We are struggling toward the creation of a community in which more of our real lived experience is known and valued. A beloved community in which more of us will be welcomed, in which more of us will find home here. This is not about identity politics. It's not about political correctness. This is about wholeness and the hope that our many hoops can finally find shelter under that one tree. We're in process, but we can't go back. And there is a hope calling us forward even through these early and awkward efforts. May we see the fractions, the spectrum, the margins. Let us open our hearts to the complexity of our worlds. Make our lives sanctuaries to nurture our many identities. The day is coming when all will know that the rainbow world is more gorgeous than monochrome, that a river of identities can ebb and flow over the static, stubborn rocks in its course, that the margins within all of us hold the center. Will you pray with me? Spirit of life and of love, great mystery that lives in us and through us. We hear the voice of justice and the hope of freedom calling us. Is it our voice, the better angels of our nature? Or is it some persistent hope in us that will not let us go? We hear that voice and we answer. We move into the unknown territory through which we must pass on the way to our visions and our dreams. We learn new ways, but we learn them slowly and discover the truth of old wisdom, but with difficulty. It is work, this building of beloved community, but we know how much depends on it. Our lives and the lives of those we love. And we know we cannot go back. And so we quiet ourselves and listen, to hear as clearly as we can that voice calling us to hope, that voice calling our names. Amen.